Our session this morning is part two in the series on the church as hospitality community. This morning we're going to talk about seeking the stranger. And I see some of you back from yesterday. And yesterday, just to give the perspective of what we're doing this week, yesterday we talked about welcoming the stranger, those who come to us. And today I'd like us to talk in just as hopeful and just as challenging terms about the people that we might seek as the hospitality of our church community. When Gary and I were commissioned to begin People of Hope, which is the mission congregation that we are co-pastors of, we were commissioned by our synod about 4 years ago, and People of Hope celebrated its third anniversary of worship last January. When we were commissioned, we had this vision that we'd like to begin a church that didn't, after a couple of years, kind of begin to nest. that we wouldn't just begin a church and then we'd have our flock gathered and we'd find a piece of land and we would settle down as this nice cozy family. What we wanted to try to do was to keep the arrows going out and to not even buy land and begin building too soon, so that it would really have the sense of outreach and of mission at its very core. And there were a number of reasons for that. And those things I think we should talk about this morning, because we're at a changing time in the church. And the landscape is changing, and I firmly believe that is really the necessity of all of our congregations, that we need to have the arrows pointing out rather than pointing in and looking at our communities of faith as sort of, well, now this is us. Now let's enjoy life together. So what we're going to do is first get our bearings by a look at a reading from Luke chapter 14, and then talk about this changing landscape as I see it. And I really want you to break in at any time and challenge what I have to say, or augment it, add your own perspectives to it. I hope that one of the things I've been looking forward to about doing this up here at Holden is this community draws particular kinds of people, folks who are willing to grapple and willing to critique, and so let's do that together. So we're going to look at Luke 14 and then talk about this changing landscape. And then, if we're going to really talk about seeking the stranger, I think we ought to talk about who's out there. Who are we trying to seek? And do we know anything in particular about those people that God calls us to be a mission to? So, the first thing is to take a look at this reading from Luke. Yesterday, we looked at the prodigal father, usually called the prodigal son story, and saw how this whole business of welcoming is God's work. And that is the theme of the church. God is the one who's at work, always, always. This is God's work. And our discernment task is to ask, what is God calling us to be? What is God calling us to do? When we are privileged to be in this place where God is at work. So today, the question before us is, what is God calling us to be or to do to invite the people of this day and age into the church? Luke 14. 16 to 23. Jesus said, "Someone gave a great dinner and invited many. At the time for the dinner, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything's ready now.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, 'Oh, I've bought a piece of land and I must go out and see it. Please accept my regrets.' Another said, 'Oh, I've bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm going to try them out. Please accept my regrets.' Another said, 'I have just been married and therefore I cannot come.' And so the slave returned and reported this to his master. And then the owner of the house became angry and said to his slave, "Go out at once into the streets and the lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame." And so the slave said, "Sir, what you've ordered has been done. There's still room." Then the master said to the slave, "Go out into the roads and the lanes and compel people to come in so that my house may be filled." Compel people to come in so that my house may be filled. I love starting with this story because God's got this banquet set. And we have this marvelous privilege of inviting people into this banquet. And so we start with a theology of abundance. The abundant, gracious, all-merciful, life-giving presence of Jesus Christ. It's set before us, and we have the privilege of going out and inviting people to the banquet. Another thing I like about this is not only the theology of abundance, it's all there for us, but again, it's God's work. We don't have to be feeling self-conscious about inviting people. This is God's work. God's set the banquet. And I'll tell you, I really hung on to this when it was time to start knocking on doors for people of hope. There's a lot of ways you can start mission churches, and one common model is to commission some families or interested individuals from other churches to gather together and begin this new church. Well, that's not the way they did it with us. There are 7 flourishing congregations in Rochester, Minnesota, and this was to be the 8th one. All 7 of the others happen to be east of the Northwest Highway artery that runs through Rochester, Highway 52. All of them being east of Highway 52, our commission was to start a church west of Highway 52. And because the city is growing rapidly in that direction. And having previously been pastors at the largest Lutheran church in town, Bethel, we were commissioned, but no other folks were commissioned with us because we really didn't want there to be a huge exodus from any one congregation. So it was us and the doors and to go start knocking on those doors. And really, I don't know that I could have done it if I'd have thought I was going out there to build a church. I had these brochures in hand, and what I really felt was this banquet story. I'm going out, and I'm passing out 3 invitations to people. Or another way to say it is, I'm planting seeds, and the banquet's already set. It's not me that's going to build a church. God's already got the banquet prepared. And boy, that made all the difference in the world for me when it came to knock on that first door or that 100th door. The banquet is set. Now, there are a lot of churches today that talk about seekers. You heard that expression regarding people who are looking for a church? And they're often called seekers, and so we use terms like seeker-sensitive worship services. Some churches are trying to have church services, worship services that are particularly sensitive to those seekers. To me, it's the other way around. To me, we're the seekers. We who are in the church are the seekers. If we take this banquet parable seriously, it is we who are going out doing the seeking. And to follow up on the prodigal father, it is the prodigal father who ran down the road to meet the returning son. And so we are the seekers, and we are seeking the stranger, the banquet attendee. The landscape is changing, and
I referenced a fellow yesterday named Lauren Mead, and he has written two, thankfully, very short books. And he has an this book is called The Once and Future Church. This is a real find, and it's less than 100 pages long. This is a real find for helping us get our bearings in the church today. And this is one of the things that it's sort of the umbrella under which he talks. He says that when the church began, this is the world, when the church began, we could see it as a small circle within the larger circle of the world. And here were these Christians, and every time they stepped outside their catacombs or their gatherings, they were in a hostile environment. And the story of Saul, who became Paul, is a good example of that. They were in a hostile environment, and they were trying to reach out to that hostile environment and share this good news, this banquet, so that their circle would grow. So that was the way it was during the early church. And it was that way for quite a while until something quite phenomenal happened about the 4th century. And that was the conversion of this fellow named Constantine. And when Constantine became a Christian and then began to declare Christianity to be the religion of the empire, the circles became identical. And to be a good citizen was to be a good Christian. And this model, which is called by this fellow Lauren Mead, he calls the Christendom model, where when you moved into a community, well, of course, you became a part of a church because that was what people did. And it is this model that has lasted from Europe, brought over to this country with the early European immigrants, and that's been the model that we've lived with for centuries. You can think of examples of that yourself, but I know of a community where even until about 10 years ago, to get a loan at the bank in this community, you had to have a referral from your pastor. Our lives together were, we understood ourselves to be in a Christian nation. We understood ourselves to live in Christian communities. And, of course, when somebody moved in down the street, we sort of expected that they would become a member of one of the churches in the area. Now, it's never been entirely accurately true. I mean, for example, we've always had Christian or Jewish people in our communities, but it has sort of been our mentality that we're a Christian nation, and that to be a good citizen, you are part of a good church, and therefore a good community, fine, upstanding member of the community. That has begun to change. And you can probably think of a place where you began to see the erosion of how we understood our communities to be Christian communities. One that occurs to me is, once upon a time, you didn't show up on Sunday. Why?
Stars were
but exactly. Then little by little, first the movie theater started showing movies on Sunday night. And then a few stores started to be opened. And now we see that, boy, in Rochester, hockey is a big thing. And Sunday morning hockey practices are not unusual. Soccer in the summer is a big thing. And traveling soccer teams where they go to other communities and play soccer all day Saturday and all day Sunday, not unusual. Nobody bats an eye anymore about, oh, but Sunday, what about church? What has happened is, if this is the world, once again, it's sort of like it was back when the apostles began. One difference, though,
When we step out of our doorstep, we are now, just like in the apostles' time, on a mission field. Difference, which gave me great courage when I began knocking on doors to begin People of Hope, is that this environment around us is not hostile like it was during the apostolic era. In fact, percentages and polls reveal all kinds of different things, but one person has put these statistics together, that in this environment that we are now stepping into every time we step outside of our church doors, only about 12% of it is hostile. This was from a poll of people who are unchurched. Only about 12% of those who are unchurched define themselves as hostile to kind of Christian churches. 43% of them said, they're indifferent. And interestingly, 45% identify themselves as open, waiting for somebody to invite them. Now, did I do my math right and remember my statistics? Yeah, that comes to 100%. Okay. That means that when I went to knock on the doors, I had, what, an 88% chance of not getting the door slammed in my face. Now, I'm in Rochester, Minnesota. This is the Midwest that I'm working. I'd say that in Rochester, Minnesota, this is much higher than 88%. In fact, never have had a door slammed in my face. Some interesting and unenthusiastic responses, yes, but never a door slammed in my face. Orange County? Yeah. Might be a different story, and these percentages not good. But what that tells us is that even though things are sort of back to the way they were when the apostles were on their mission field, we've got a far more inviting environment in which to go out and extend these banquet invitations that Luke 14 talks about. So, let me get to the time here. Any comments or questions or reflections that you
have?
Where
is the hostile?
Well, go ahead.
In the church.
Go ahead.
Our church is in, we have two traditional services, 8 o'clock and 10:45. And we, 2 years ago, about 2.5 years ago, we started what was kind of, we didn't refer to it as a seeker service, we just called it a contemporary worship service. And it has drums and bass and keyboard and singers, which in the model that we used were called worship team. Mm-hmm. There's an affront within our congregation that's what they're called, because the pastor is the worship person. There is an affront that of people who think that, who don't know what this worship service is about, but who have not bothered to come and see and are criticizing it anyway. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of the hostility within our, what do I want to say, old guard.
Former members or
no,
current
long-term members who are extremely hostile to that service, because it's both drawing from the outside, but also from within our established congregation. There's a shift to that service, and it's causing a lot of problems.
There are conflicts that this whole business of being in mission cause. Let's remember that, and you're absolutely on target, incredible hostility can come from the people who used to be in power in the church, and with the shifting sands are losing some of that. But this percentage, this hostility comes from unchurched people. And what's the sense of that? I would suspect that some of those unchurched have bad memories and bad experiences somewhere, and they won't darken the door of a church again. Some of that might simply be, simply isn't correct to say, might be strong ideological differences with Christianity, active, vociferous atheism.
Are atheists hostile to the church?
Not all.
Not necessarily.
No, not all. Some might be very engaged in the whole business of spirituality. But what I like to see in this, however, is that our mission field, the fields are wide and harvest waiting. our mission field is a live one. Now, who's out there? That kind of is along the line of what you were asking. Who's out there? And some people have profiled the unchurched in our present culture. And some have said that we could generally profile the unchurched people in this way. They're biblically illiterate, ritually incompetent, highly self-conscious individualists who have a vague spiritual hunger, and living, as we all do, in an increasingly privatized world. Let's run back through that again. It's kind of interesting. Biblically illiterate. People don't know Bible. And I hazard to say that's in our churches as well as among the unchurched. Now, biblical images are still, you see them in our culture. And Dr. Martin Luther King was an incredible one to make use of biblical imagery in a social context. But generally speaking, if you refer to Noah, or Moses, you can't always count on the fact that somebody's going to know who you're talking about. And one woman who came to People of Hope said, you know, I went to a church Sunday night Bible study for 3 years, and I never took a Bible with me. And I always pretended I forgot it. And I'm going, for 3 years? And she said, I know, it sounds really stupid. And I kind of felt it really stupid every Sunday night showing up for this Bible study and not having a Bible with me. And she said, but you know what it did is I don't know my Bible, and so I had to sit next to somebody else every time that did know their Bible, because I didn't know how to find those references they were always telling us to turn to. And so I got to just always look on, and nobody knew that I didn't know where to turn. Biblically illiterate. She preferred the embarrassment of saying week after week, I forgot my Bible, to fessing up to not knowing her Bible. Isn't it interesting? A Bible class is the only class we offer where people think that to take it, they have to already know what you're going to cover. Well, I take your Bible class, Pastor, but you don't know my Bible very well. Whereas if I was offering a calligraphy class, nobody would come up to me and say, well, I take your class, but I can't calligraphy very well. You go, for goodness sake, that's why we're offering the class. But people are hesitant to take a Bible class because they feel like, oh, I don't know my Bible well enough. Biblically illiterate culture. Ritually incompetent. Incompetent here is not a negative term. What it means is that people don't know what we do in our worship services. And they don't know why we stand up and sit down when we do. Now, I love the liturgy, and a lot of my education is steeped in understanding the deep and meaningful historical rhythms of our liturgy. But when somebody who hasn't been in church for 20, 30 years and has this kind of vague wondering if going to a church is maybe the answer, and they come in and sit down, and the first thing we ask them to do is to stand up and confess their sins, they don't know what this is about and what we're going to ask them to do next. They don't understand our rituals. And they don't understand who can take communion and why and how do you do it and what am I going to get when I get up there. You know, we don't realize the extent to which people are unfamiliar, even when we give them a worship guide with it all clearly laid out. There's still wonder about these rituals that we have. One thing we did with People of Hope Worship is we moved the confession to after the sermon, the message. We don't use the term sermon either, we use the term message. We moved it there because if somebody has walked into the church after having been away for 20, 30 years, it is in the, after the word is proclaimed that they can release to God what they have held in their hearts for maybe decades. And so that's one small change that we've made on the basis of recognizing that people don't know what they're going to be asked to do when they step inside our churches. Okay, biblically illiterate, ritually incompetent, highly self-conscious individualists. One woman drove quite a few miles after seeing one of the initial articles about People of Hope in the newspaper. She drove quite a few miles to come to Bandera Valley School where we're worshiping. The first Sunday, she drove past and looked at our signs. The second Sunday, she came all those miles again, and she actually worked up the nerve to drive through the parking lot. So it loops, and she drove through the parking lot. It was only the third Sunday that she finally worked up the courage to stop the car, get out, and walk in. And when she walked through the door, how incredibly important it was that we had this little name tag table and a friendly face to say, hi, this is what we do and this is where you go. Because she was dying. Just dying inside. It took all her courage to come. And this woman is 80 years old. 80 years old. So, biblically illiterate, ritually incompetent, highly self-conscious individualists living in an increasingly privatized world. And I don't have to tell you about that. I'm just going to run a scenario that you know well. It's possible for a person to get up in the morning by the radio, to eat breakfast through the Today Show or Good Morning America, turn it off, walk out into their connected garage, push a button to open the garage door, back out of the car, out of the garage, drive to work, park in the parking ramp, take the self-operated elevator up to their office, sit at the office desk and work whatever the job is, or assembly line, maybe sit at the computer all day, maybe for a diversion over the lunch hour, get back into the car and go through the McDonald's drive-thru, and sit down by themselves at a park bench and enjoy a summer day, and then come back to the office. Time to go home, get back in the car, drive in the garage after pushing the button, open and shut the door, don't have to talk to the neighbors, don't have to see the neighbors, go in, get a lemonade, go out on their, not front, but back door deck, which is carefully secluded with shrubberies and fencing. Maybe come in and have dinner in front of the TV and then get up and go get on the internet for a couple hours while the kids are playing Nintendo games. Retrieve a few messages off the answering machine, leave a few messages on a few other answering machines, and go to bed. And have very, very little human contact. And then for those people, as well as for ourselves, to be invited into a hospitality community, what does that mean? How terribly intimidating it is, and will be increasingly so as more and more our lives are becoming more and more privatized technologically. And then again, biblically illiterate, ritually incompetent, highly self-conscious individuals living in an increasingly privatized society, but possessing a vague spiritual hunger. Spirituality is a huge business in this country now. Huge business. Money galore is being made on all kinds of spiritual journeys and all kinds of spiritual, you can buy tapes, you can buy self-help this, you can get in touch with your inner whatever, you can get into all kinds of therapies, and there's this vague spiritual hunger that is a common thing in our culture. And we have for them the banquet that will fill that hunger. So that's who's out there. And the question is, what do you think God is calling us to be or to do so that when we step onto our mission field as our churches, we can reach out to the people of our day, which is who God is commissioning us to reach to. When people sign on to our mission statement and join People of Hope, People of Hope have decided to call themselves not members, but member missionaries. And it's gotten to be kind of fun because it wasn't too long after we adopted our constitution that said to be a member of People of Hope meant to be a member missionary that somebody figured out that was to be an M&M. And so guess what? We have a theme candy. I'm going to write to M&M Company because we're making all kinds of money for them. Last Advent, a Christmas tree showed up that somebody had brought and had strung those little M&M Christmas lights on it. And every time we have a new member Sunday, guess what gets passed out to everybody is little packets of M&Ms. And we have great fun with it. But the point is, you're a missionary when you join People of Hope. And our church council is not called a council. It's called a mission leadership team. What we're trying to do is keep in front of people that the arrows are going out. We've been worshiping about a year and a half, and we raised the question, Gary and I did, whether it wasn't time to go to two services. Guess what was the immediate negative thought about going to two services? What would we...
Didn't want to be divided.
We'd lose our community a little bit. We won't see everybody anymore. Well, but then we start talking about, but why are we here? What are we here for? And the decision early in this church's young life was to go to two services so that we'd be more accessible to people. If we worship twice, then it's far easier for people to pick one of those two services rather than just having one service. I am so thankful that the people stepped back themselves and said, wait a minute, yeah, that's why we're here. So that when we invite somebody, we can say the banquet's laid twice. It's set at 8:30 and it's set at 10:30. Whichever one you're able to come to, please do. A mission emphasis to how we see our communities. So let's talk about it. What do you see? What are your thoughts?
We started a small group of Bible studies at the church.
Mm-hmm.
We met in homes that were between 5 and 10. When I started my group, I had 5 members there. We were there every Sunday. We graduated a little bigger the last time I was there. There were 10 members there.
Ah, that's wonderful.
Very much. And it's a real feeling we have for each other.
Family feeling.
Yeah. And that is one of the things people are hungering for. When people have that vague spiritual hunger, one thing they'll often be able to define is they're looking for a sense of hope and a sense of home. And to be connected to somebody, in a very increasingly privatized world, is a hunger, a strong hunger. And small groups is a wonderful way. It's a wonderful way to bring people into the larger community as well. Well, come to me with my small, into my small group, and maybe, you know, someday you'd be able to come to
worship. We have about four small groups in our church.
Oh, that's wonderful.
They're all growing.
And you know, small groups is a new movement, but women of the church have been at it for decades. They've been called circles. Yes.
Well, this is kind of a different perspective. We've been members of 9 different churches.
Yeah,
we've been all over the country.
That yesterday.
And our experience has been, we've gotten to be professional going into churches. And our experience has been that 9 out of 10 Lutheran churches you go into, the only person who talks to you is the pastor. And very often, it's the only person that makes eye contact. Our last experience in changing communities, we went to 17 different Lutheran churches. I kept notes on the different churches, trying to find some place that we could really feel that was active, that was welcoming. And I went to the bishop, discussed it with him. But
You're good at this. A church,
you have to, when you talk about these people, how fearful, what an experience it is to try and walk into a church full of strangers and everybody else knows each other.
Right.
I mean, we were, like I said, almost professional at it because we moved so much. We've forced ourselves into various communities, whether it's the church or civic or whatever it is. When you think of people for whom they haven't had this experience, and to walk into a church and walk out and not have anybody even make eye contact. It's really, and the sad part of it is, we found that was the main experience we had in Lutheran churches. And that is scary, because everybody gets to church and they're, oh, well, I haven't seen so-and-so for 2 weeks, and how was your vacation? And that person who is trying probably to slip out the door, but would really like to have somebody talk to them.
Yes, yes.
Just disappears.
And what you're saying is that we clergy try a little bit, but what you're asking,
Sunday morning too.
But you're asking that the community,
in fact,
say,
when I get back now, I'm a volunteer coordinator at our church, and it's a large. For us, it's a very large church, the largest we belong to. We will start a new greeter program instead of the greeter at the door saying, good morning, how are you? We are going to get probably 50 or 60 people together at a potluck and discuss how we can do this better. My vision is to have people, maybe 5 or 6, 8 people at a service assigned to really that Sunday, forget about your friends, look for
people who
are new or even people who you don't know. Because I've been there 4 years now, we have 1,400 members, that's a lot of people. I don't know, but it's still my job to go up and say, I don't believe I've met you yet.
You can say that whether they've been there 10 years or not.
You have to say, are you new?
No.
And be embarrassed because they've been here for 4 years, and you say, I haven't met you yet. No.
Because that's your truth. And that's all
but
that you need to have to
say. Any of this outreach business is just welcoming those who finally stumble in the door.
Yeah. One of my, this is what we're doing also, we call them secret greeters, and they're people who are trained to be kind of, they aren't the person who stands at the door and is conspicuous, but someone who is more a rover and just kind of mingles in the narthex or wherever people might be coming in and just, but here's the problem again. One of the things that we're having to address at our church is that there's a group of people who seem to think that the feeling I have is that we have a club, and we know who the members are, and it's very uncomfortable to have all these new people who would like to become members, but we don't know them, and it's changing the whole tone of the whole place, and
yes.
You know, I mean, this is,
yes.
And this we're all from the same church here. And this small group thing has been wonderful because and we'll have more of them, it will allow people to find their niche. You used to have that, if you belong to a choir or whatever, you know. Now we're making groups that will allow people to have a small group of people that they feel, you have to do that if you have a larger church. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, too many people slip through the cracks.
You have to do it when you're starting a small church.
Yeah, that's true.
Finding ways for people's gifts to come out. And that's what we're going to talk more about on Thursday when the session is not welcoming the stranger or seeking the stranger, but blessed by the stranger. People come with gifts. And what do we do to cherish that and to let the banquet be flourishing because of that? Other thoughts that you have? One of the things that I get some grief for among people of hope, but they really like it, is the Sunday morning greeting thing. I'll usually get up and I'll say, look around and find somebody you've never talked to before. Now suddenly everybody's on the same level, because there aren't just insiders and outsiders. If you're the first time there or the 50th time there, you're all looking around for somebody you've never talked to before. And then I always come up with some little thing that they have to do two things, share your name and then something that's kind of related to the theme for the day, but something secular, whether it's share what you like about spring, or what's your favorite color socks, or what's the dirtiest you've ever been. That's what I did last week, because I was talking about getting our hands dirty for the gospel, and so what's the dirtiest you've ever been? And people do give me grief. They go, oh, you're going to make us do that again? But so often, people have come up to me and said, you know, I'm friends now with so-and-so. Well, how'd you meet them?
Well, it's when you told us to look around for somebody we never met before.
There are ways that we can all be looking for ways to connect. And as you said, I've had people, folks say, well, I can't go up and greet somebody. What if they've been there since the beginning and I didn't know it? And as you so beautifully pointed out, but if you didn't meet them, you've never met them, and you can say, hi, I'm so-and-so, I don't believe we've met.
Or you can admit that I don't remember your name. I know I've seen you, but who are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We have name tags, which help a little bit, I think.
Do you get people to use them?
Well, sometimes.
The same ones don't.
We have two, but they don't.
Yeah, some put them on and some don't.
Well, they're kind of a pain.
They can be, unless you're
new. I have mine at home, and I try to remember to put it on when I put it on every Sunday morning. I'm at church, I don't remember to do that.
Now, for missionaries, let's learn from the rich tradition of missionaries that our church has. If I was going to be sent by the church to Zaire, what's the very first thing that the church would do to prepare me, other than give me my shots and stuff? They'd send me to learn French. They'd send me for intensive months, 3 or 6 months of intensive language study. And then they would put me in a village where I would learn whatever indigenous dialect I'm going to be headed to. Let's learn from that. If we're on a mission field, then we need to learn to speak the language of our culture. And I suspect that a lot of our churches are speaking, if we go with Lauren Mead's analysis of Christendom and our new era being a post-Christendom era, I think a lot of our churches are still speaking Christendomese, if we could call that a language. We use words that, boy, people don't understand. And I'd like to invite you to come to our celebration of the Holy Eucharist. And they're going to say, huh? but to say, come to the Lord's banquet that we're having at our church. It's completely different. We need to learn to talk to the people that God has placed us on the mission field to talk to. And it really is almost language study for us. Gary and I find ourselves translated a dialect and spent his whole pastoral career translating in a village in, not New Guinea. Well, anyway, in some small African country, Gary and I find ourselves, we're constantly translating. And not just the big words like intinction or expiation, but even words like hymn, we say song. We don't say benediction, we say blessing. And I've had to just discard all kinds of what I thought were wonderful sermons that referred to all kinds of, used all kinds of language that you'd only know if you went through Lutheran confirmation class. But it isn't just the pastors that are needing to translate. It's all of us, because we are needing to speak to our culture. Not selling out to it, but we got to talk to it. That's what the Great Commission is all about.
The thing that I hear, and I have to be mindful of this, because earlier your husband, one of the things he said was something about not allowing the devil an opportunity. It was in Ephesians, I can't remember what exactly the quote was, but what I have to remember is that there is a group of people here who are hurting that those very things that you're talking about changing are a loss for them.
Yes.
They want the word Eucharist. They want the word into, you know, whatever. They want those things that are part of their rich history and, yes, and tradition to, they see that as loss. And how do we make that transition between being able to communicate? Part of the frustration with our service is that there are those of us who understand that if you want to give unchurched and people who have not been trained in the Lutheran Church an experience of God, you have to do it in music they can relate to.
Mm.
You cannot, I mean, there's a reason why you hear the Little Brown Church in the Vale and what's that other one that people sing at funerals of a certain age. And they are not relatable to my generation, other than they're what I think of when my parents aged die. We must speak to people in music, in a kind, a style of music that they can relate to. How do we do that without the people who are further back with this rich tradition of language? This is a tough thing.
This is where our church is right now. It's on that struggle. You see it in discussions of styles of worship. You see it in discussions of language. What version of the Lord's Prayer?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that the new version has been around for like 25 years now?
Yeah.
So music, language, if you're going to change a whole worship service, not just the songs you sing, but the whole form of the liturgy, this is where our church is right now. And maybe some of your churches are trying new kinds of worship services, sometimes called contemporary services. Not to offend anybody who might like this kind of music, but I shudder when I hear about a church that says we're making some new changes, we're going to do a folk liturgy. Who listens to folk music? Turn your radio on. Nobody listens to folk music. Jazz, yes. Country, yes. Rock, yes. Classical music, yes. There is still a place for that. But our whole Lutheran tradition has been the deep, wonderful classical tradition of chorales and so forth.
I think along this line, particularly if you're in a city that's large enough to have several different Lutheran churches, the important thing is to pick the style of worship that fits your particular community of believers best and do it very, very well.
Yes.
Let somebody else do another, well, folk music thing, and if they can do it very well, they can attract those people.
Yes.
We attract people, we do a very traditional service, but it's always varied, and it isn't straight out of the hymn book. We don't, yeah. But we do it very well. We have very fine musicians, and we attract people who are unchurched, who are, we very seldom really get very many Lutherans in our new member classics. They're usually from all different backgrounds or no background at all. But that worship experience is done very, very well. And that's what brings them and keeps them to begin with.
Yes. Yes.
And we have other churches across town that do something totally different in their worship style, but they do it well. If you don't do your worship service well, doesn't matter what style it is.
You have to have a consistently good worship service so that, as somebody has said, you communicate to people it's worth stopping their lawnmower, walking over, and inviting their neighbor to, and you give your member confidence in knowing that if they bring somebody, it's going to be worth the glory of God's praise.
I would like to get back more onto the topic for today of seeking. I think it seems to me like we're more onto what yesterday's was.
A little bit,
welcoming when they're in, because I think in my territory, we don't get many people that will come, that except some relatives or people visiting from out of town or things like that. But as far as new people coming in, we need to try and get them in. We aren't getting them in, and I know you've talked about going knocking on doors. We're in an area where a lot of apartment buildings and that, and there just often isn't much access to, and so how do we get these people to come in?
You know what's one of the new, most effective, or projected to be one of the most effective outreach tools is a church website.
Restaurant?
A church website. That new computer stuff. Because that's where people are looking. A lot of people are looking. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that we're looking for in our church is to retain the Luther leaguers when they get to be 18, that they stay in the church instead of go somewhere else.
I'm going to have a session earlier next week with the minors and junior minors, and it's going to be the church I would bring my best friend to is blank, and I want them to tell us what would they bring their best friends to. But a couple, it's time to quit. How about we do that? But then if anyone wants to stay, I'd love to hear some of the ways that you get the invitation out to the larger community, because that is the key to seeking the stranger, to put something into the language and then get it out there. You know, the church, we have what everyone's hungry for. How do we let them know? Let's pray. Dear God, thank you that again this day you have welcomed us to the feast of living in your presence and by your grace. And thank you for this beautiful day and this community that we enjoy here. As we think about those communities that we cherish, that we left, guide us, Lord, to have missionary spirits and lead us forward to the people who are hungering to be invited. In your name we pray. Amen. Anybody got some? Feel free to go if you have to, but in ways you get the invitation out.
In the last year, we've had two door knocker. We have a group called Wagoneers that take a small loaf of quick bread.
To a visitor?
To a home, yes. The first time visitor gets a small loaf of bread with a little with a thing that tells, a flyer type of thing that tells about our church, and a personal handwritten note from our pastor. Times of a card with our word, we have church cards that we give out to people if they want them, and that has the times of our worship and can't think what else. Anyhow, just put in a bag and put on a doorknob if the people are not home. If they are at home, it is a quick knock on the door. We know you worship with us today. We're so glad you were here. Just
thanks for coming.
See you later. Just a little while.